be a periodic series on Sunday nights. Periodic because we do different things on Sunday nights. We have singing nights once a month, and I may do some other things in there, but periodically we will visit this topic, much like we've done other topics in the past. We did a whole series on lessons from the Holy Lands, and we've done lessons on the parables, and this one I've given several options, and overwhelmingly folks said, hey, we want that Unsolved Mysteries that series of lessons. Let me tell you where this comes from. So several years ago, when I was at Bellevue Church, I wasn't on staff, but I taught there at Bellevue without a break for 12 years. So I had a permanent class. It's like that was my residency. I was a little bit of a rebel in that I didn't really follow the quarter system, though they wanted me to. I just taught what I wanted to and finished it when I wanted to. Anyway, and when I would, if I didn't already have an idea of what was coming next, I would ask for suggestions. Well, this, Kate was in my class. Sunday morning, she would go to the youth group class, but on Wednesday night, she would come to my class. And Kate said, I have a suggestion. And she said, I heard a speaker one time that just did one sermon, I think, talking about all these questions in the Bible that you can't answer. And she said, just that little snippet was so fascinating. It would be fun to have a class on that. And I was like, well, how do you sustain a class for 13 plus weeks of questions that you can't answer? And so she gave me some examples of what she was talking about. And she and I together worked up a list of questions. And I'll tell you, I don't get nervous about beginning new studies very often. I was pretty nervous about, again, getting through that and keeping people engaged. And it ended up being one of the most popular classes that I've ever had in my history of teaching. And the approach that I took was, because I could literally get up here every week and go, all right, who's the Pharaoh of the Exodus? We don't know. And then just go sit down, you know. But the approach that I took was, we talk about why we don't know, but then get to the real, like, why is it irrelevant to find out the answer? Why is it not important that we find out the answer? And in many cases, it's because there's something else out of that story or out of that event or whatever that is more significant that demands our attention, which is the case tonight. And so I'm going to, you know, use those same questions. I'm going to revisit those every week. I'll talk more about that in just a minute. But I'm going to use those same questions structured a little differently because these are sermons and not classes, even though I kind of treat Sunday night like a class, to go through that. The first one that we're going to do tonight, oh, one more thing. Most of you guys know this, but for those of you that don't, when I do the handouts, at the bottom, there is always a web address where you can get an electronic copy of the handout. But not only the handout, you also get all my notes, okay? For example, this one, there's over 50 pages of notes, okay? Now, if I posted this on Facebook on Saturday, that was yesterday. Ooh, yeah, yesterday. And when I posted it, if any of you happened to pull it up yesterday, you go, well, there weren't 50 pages of what I downloaded. There was only 40 pages. I added 10 more this afternoon. That's why I say I revisit these. I'm coming back and, you know, really digging them all back up again. And so even the handout changed from yesterday to this afternoon. But there's over 50 pages of notes with this one for anybody that has an interest. I'm going to create them whether you have an interest or not, but they're out there. But tonight's question is, who is the Pharaoh of the Exodus? Now, one thing I will say about the handout is that we're not going to go directly, completely in order of what's on the handout, because the handout is kind of like a jigsaw puzzle in that I have to make the stuff that I want on there fit, and sometimes I can't make it fit in order. And so some of this, we're going to jump back and forth. So I may tell you to flip it or flip it or flip it or flip it, and we'll just go back and forth, okay? But the question tonight is, who was the Pharaoh of the Exodus? Jeff and I did not coordinate this, even though on Wednesday he told me he was going to be covering Exodus in our class this morning. I had already gone too far down the rabbit hole of doing this lesson on Exodus to reverse course, but these are definitely complementary lessons rather than covering the same material. I told Jeff after class this morning, I said, thank you for not identifying who the Pharaoh was. It's a little bit of a joke, we don't know. But anyway, this is a complimentary lesson. But something that Jeff said this morning really jumped out at me, and that was the popularity of this story, the Exodus story. He talked about how it's something that we know from, if we grew up in church, we've known the Exodus story since we're little, and the pieces of that story fit very well into Sunday school lessons and EBS lessons. And I would even go beyond that to say, this is one of the most known stories for people that are not followers of God. There have been at least, that I know about, three Hollywood movies. I'm not talking about, you know, little Bible things. I mean Hollywood blockbuster movies over the decades about this story. And I, you know, I don't, who was the Ten Commandments? Cecil DeVille. I don't know if he was a believer or not. I don't know anything about him. But I have to believe that Hollywood is more interested in prophets than they are about presenting a story about God. Most of you know that my family, right before we took Kate to Harding the weekend before, we spent 4 days in New York. One of the reasons why we went up there was one of my favorite of all time music groups was performing twice that weekend. And we went and saw them twice in MetLife Stadium, which holds 80,000 people. The very first song and the very first show, and this band, I'm not going to mention who they are, but to my knowledge, they are not believers. I'd be shocked if any of them claimed that they were. The very first song in the very first show, the entirety of that song is about this story. There's 80,000 people singing along, and I don't know how many of them understand the significance of the Exodus story or not, but if you look at the lyrics of the song, it's like, it is dead on accurate of what's in the Bible. Again, they're not believers. I said, this is one of the most popular stories in the history of the world. But to us, it's more than that, more than just a popular story. This is, you know, I almost put in here without a doubt, and I think I changed it to perhaps, the greatest salvation event in the Old Testament. But within this story, you have not only the salvation event that is a foreshadowing, that was Jeff's lesson, drawing the parallels between the physical salvation of Israel and the salvation, spiritual salvation that we receive through Jesus Christ. But also a foreshadowing, a shadow of Jesus as the Passover lamb. The Passover lamb that the blood was painted on the doorpost and allowed the destroyer, the hand of God, to pass over the children of Israel. And now, I mean, again, we've done lessons on this. I'm not going to go too deep into this. We've done multiple lessons on this. Jesus is the Passover lamb. I mean, the gospel writers, especially John, I mean, just hold it up and say, he was the Passover lamb. I mean, if we get the chronology right, most likely Jesus was being crucified at the same time that the Passover lambs were being killed in the temple in observation of the Feast of Passover. So it's a foreshadowing, a physical salvation event, a massive salvation event that foreshadows the spiritual salvation that we enjoy through the true Passover lamb that is Jesus Christ. But in this story, in which Pharaoh is very prominent, we don't know who he is. We don't know who he is. We don't know who the Pharaoh, and most likely throughout the entirety of this story, there's more than one Pharaoh. Because a period of time passes. You know, when the story begins in Exodus 1, Moses is not born, right? And Moses grows up to, 40 years old before he leaves, and he comes back when he's 80. And, I mean, time, there's a lot of time that passes. And so you likely had one Pharaoh who gave the edict to have all the Jewish babies killed, and another Pharaoh who was the actual Pharaoh of the Exodus, and maybe even some in between. So, but we don't know who the Pharaoh was who was the Pharaoh who threw the plagues. We don't know who that was. And I've got on the handout, this is on the front page, under background, after that, it's why is this unsolved? The primary reason it's unsolved is because the Pharaoh is unnamed in the book of Exodus. Okay? You may go, what about Exodus 1:1 that talks about the town, the city of Ramses? We'll get to that. Okay? We'll get to that. But the Pharaoh is unnamed. And, you know, today, in hindsight, the way we reckon time is BC and AD, and there's no time markers in Exodus that say, like, well, this happened in, you know, 1700 or 1400 or 1300 BC. That doesn't exist. It's not in the book of Exodus. I mean, some places you have, you know, references to periods of years, you know, 400 years that they were in captivity, but we don't know the starting and the ending, right? So we don't know the chronology. We don't know the timeline. We'll get to more of that in just a minute, okay? We don't know the timeline. And so I've got that as the second point. There's no accounting of time in the Old Testament. Fixed points of time. Again, there are periods of years that are mentioned, but not fixed points of time. And then, outside of Scripture, there's a whole study of Egypt called Egyptology. And within Egyptology, there is lots of debate. Forget about the Exodus story. Forget about the Pharaoh of the Exodus. Forget about Moses. There's a lot of debate within the scholars in Egyptology about just Egyptian chronology, the Egyptian timeline. And so they can't agree on what Pharaoh served when. So you have an unknown on top of an unknown on top of an unknown, which leads to the answer, we don't know. Okay, we don't know. I've got in there a note. I don't want to go too deep on this because I am not an Egyptologist. Okay, I know just enough to be dangerous. But I've got in here under the third one, two kind of subpoints here. That, and we're going to reference this in just a minute, but there was a, in 3rd century B.C., so we're thinking B.C., 3rd century, that's the 400s, okay? You know, when you're thinking backwards, okay, 3rd century B.C., and did I say that right? No, that'd be the 300s. It would be the 300s. Anyway, thinking backwards, it messes with my brain. But we're thinking backwards. You have this Egyptian priest and historian who writes this, who takes all of the pharaohs that served, that ruled, and he organizes them chronologically into dynasties. Okay, we think of dynasties, we tend to think about, you know, Asian countries, but he took the pharaohs and he organized them into dynasties. Okay, and then there's the complicating factor that the Egyptians kept record of time using an astronomical cycle called the Sothic cycle, which many modern scholars think was wildly inaccurate. Okay, I could not articulate why they think it's inaccurate. They just, if you read from any source, they will say they believe that the Egyptians were not good at keeping track of time. Okay, so again, all of that just adds into every one of those is a variable that says we don't know. We don't know. Okay. Now, I did mention in this that modern scholars, and when I say modern, I mean within the last couple hundred years, they have developed revised timelines. Yes?
Is the Sothic cycle an astronomical cycle?
Yes.
Do you know what the factors determine?
I do not. Yeah, I do not. I do not. They have revised the timeline of taking the dynasties that Manetho put together. They have revised the timeline. And there are three different revisions of the timeline. So they can't even agree on which revised timeline they're going to go with. Now, the most popular one they call the high revision, and that's the one we're going to look at. We're going to look at here in just a minute. But they go with the high revision. Okay, so that's why we don't know. That's why we don't know who it is. Okay, but if you want to use some like back of napkin math, here is one way to make a guess as to who it was. Okay. If you go to the book of 1 Kings chapter 6, and you don't have to go there. I've got it printed in the handout. I mean, you're welcome to go there. But 1 Kings chapter 6 begins this way. In the 480th year after the people of Israel came out of the land of Egypt. Did you catch that? Now, again, that doesn't tell us when. That doesn't tell us when it started. But it says, in the 480th year after the people of Israel came out of the land of Egypt, in the fourth year of Solomon's reign. So we have this. This is kind of like a timestamp without a time, without a date, right? We know that this is describing that in the fourth year of Solomon's reign, we are 480 years removed from the Exodus. Okay. Well, can we pinpoint? If we can't pinpoint when the Exodus occurred, can we pinpoint when Solomon reigned? Now, there is a book written by Edward Thiel called The Mysterious Numbers of the Hebrew Kings that is kind of like the de facto standard that most scholars use for dating the time of the kings of Israel. Okay? But again, keep in mind, it's based on a lot of guesswork, okay? But he dates that Solomon began his reign in 971 or 970 BC. That is, we generally, like when I'm taking groups in Israel, we talk about Solomon most likely reigned in the 10th century. He's pinpointing it very specifically and saying his reign began in 970, 971. Again, do we know exactly when Solomon's reign began? No, we do not. But 970 or 971. So then the fourth year of the reign would be 967 or 966. Yes, sir? I think it's just more an acknowledgement of that you cannot pinpoint it to a specific time, so he's giving himself a two-year buffer. Does that make sense? From Thiel?
It would be 1 year.
Right, but I mean, well, any time within those 2 years. You with me? So sometime in 971 or 970, which is a two-year period of time, I think he's saying that this is as far as I'm willing to narrow it down to is 2 years. But again, I would say I think there's probably a fair amount of guesswork that goes into even narrowing it down to a two-year period rather than, you know, a bigger period of time. So if we go on that, then that would put it 967, 966. Then, if you subtract 480 years, you come out to 1447, 1446. Okay? You got everybody asleep yet? We've just been talking numbers, okay? So now, if you flip over the handout, we're going to skip over the Exodus 1 part and flip over the handout, okay? This is a chart from the 18th dynasty of pharaohs, okay? And this is the timeline is the revised high timeline. Again, I mentioned that there's three different revised timelines. There's a low, medium, and high. The most popular one of these among modern scholars, is, from my understanding, is the high timeline, which is what I have printed here. And the notes that I have in there really point to some of those things point to evidence that these might be the people beyond just the timeline. Okay, you with me? Some evidence that might be, there as to who this Pharaoh was that's not just purely doing all that math and coming out with the year. Okay, So there's three of these that I want to point out. These are all from the 18th dynasty. So in 1546 to 1525, you have the reign of Amenhotep I. And this one is really just based on timeline and understanding how old Moses was, that if ultimately Amenhotep II is the Pharaoh of the Exodus, then that would have meant Amenhotep I was the Pharaoh who decreed that the Jewish firstborn would be killed. Okay. But what's to me the most fascinating story in this whole 18th dynasty, you may have heard of this individual before, but in the 18th dynasty, there is actually a woman, female, Pharaoh. And I have got her listed there in the middle, Hatshepsut, and I've put in parentheses queen, but she ruled consecutively with Thutmose III, both as Pharaoh. Okay? Now, Hatshepsut was the daughter of Thutmose I, but she married into being an heir of the throne by marrying her half brother, Thutmose II. And when Thutmose II died, she became Pharaoh along with her nephew / stepbrother, my own grandpa then, yeah, right? Stepson. She became Pharaoh along with her nephew / stepson, Thutmose III. Yes, sir? Well, so if you will look, she reigned beyond the time of the stepson. She reigned 11 years longer. So what I read, she was generally considered to be having more power than he did during their consecutive reign. So though it did overlap, she did also overlap with Amenhotep II. Sorry, I lost my train of thought here. So because of this, again, all of this is complete speculation. Okay, understand that. Okay, and I want to reiterate, I am not an Egyptologist, I'm not a historian. Okay, I'm doing my best here. Okay, so if this were the right timeline, that would lead to the question, was this the daughter of Pharaoh who withdrew Moses from the Nile River? She was a daughter of Pharaoh. If that were the case, she would have been going against the decree of her grandfather. Again, just a speculation. We have no idea. But then that would have put in the timeline Amenhotep II as the Pharaoh of the Exodus. The interesting thing about him that is outside of the timeline is that two things. One is most pharaohs in the 18th dynasty lived in the city of Memphis. But he, and I've got this in the notes, he lived in Thebes, which is much closer to Goshen. And what's the significance of Goshen? Anybody?
Where the children of Israel.
It's where the children of Israel were. They were in Goshen. And so Amenhotep lived near Goshen, and Memphis was much, much further away. And it's also from archaeology at the Great Sphinx, where they have found a thing called the Dream Stela, evidence that Amenhotep's heir was not his eldest son, that his heir was a younger son. Why could that be significant? Because the Pharaoh of the Exodus, his son was taken in the final plague. And so, again, possibility that fits. Now, the next question I have on there is, because you may be going, well, I saw the movie The Ten Commandments. The Pharaoh was Ramses, right? I mean, I saw The Ten Commandments. This is for those of us that are older. We saw The Ten Commandments. We saw Yul Brynner Yul Brynner played Ramses, right? It's Ramses. It has to be him. That's what every Hollywood movie has, that this is Ramses, okay? The problem is, well, let me tell you where that comes from first. If you flip the handout back over, okay? In the first chapter of Exodus, it says in verse 11, "Therefore they set taskmasters over them all, over the Jews, to afflict them with heavy burdens. They built for Pharaoh store cities, Pithom and Ramses." Okay? Now Ramses did not rule. If you'll notice that Amenhotep was 1450 to 1423. There's been two Ramses, Ramses the first and Ramses the second. Ramses the second is Ramses the Great. The second did not reign, and the first did not reign until 1292, the second 1279. So we're talking about completely different timelines. Okay? Completely different timelines. And so it's extremely unlikely that Ramses was the Pharaoh of the Exodus, because we're talking about almost a couple of hundred years later. So why, though, is there a city named Ramses in Exodus chapter 1 if Ramses had not yet ruled? Okay, I think there's a very easy explanation for that. If you go back to, and you don't have to go there, if you go to the book of Genesis chapter 14, you will read a story about Abraham and Lot. And Lot was taken prisoner by a group of kings. The chief of those was a king named Chedorlaomer, who had possession of Lot. And it says that Abraham chased him all the way to Dan. Now, what's the problem with that? There was no Dan when Abraham was alive. Who was Dan? Dan was a son of anybody? Dan was one of the 12 sons of Jacob. Okay? Dan was one of the sons of Jacob. Okay? There wasn't a tribe or city of Dan until the tribes were named after the sons of Jacob. So why is that town referred to in Genesis 14 as Dan? Well, most likely what happened was they were copying manuscripts hundreds of years later. They're like, no one's going to know this as Laish, which is what it would have been known at the time of Abraham. They're going to know it as what? Dan. So we're going to put in the name of what it's called now. I feel confident that's what's happening here in Exodus 1, that this is a later manuscript, and they copied the name of what it's known as now. You know, I was thinking about in modern times, I used to play golf. That was one of my hobbies. I have since completely and utterly given that up, and my desire is to never play golf again for the rest of my life. But I still love to watch golf on television. And one of the tournaments that is early in the season, in the early spring, late winter, early spring, known today as the AT&T Pebble Beach Pro-Am. And it's always on television because it is a pro-am. It's professionals and amateurs, and a big chunk of the amateurs are celebrities. And if they're not celebrities, they are like CEOs of massive companies. Right, and it's played over 4 days. The first 3 days they rotate three different courses, and then they have a cut, and the fourth day they play at Pebble Beach. And it's known as the Pebble Beach Pro-Am. Well, that tournament was started in 1937 by Bing Crosby. And the official name of it was the Bing Crosby. It became known as the Bing Crosby National Pro-Am, but everybody called it the Bing Crosby Clam Bake. And it was known that until 1977, which was, no, until 1985. He died in 77. It continued to be known as that until 85, until it was changed to the Pebble Beach Pro-Am, and then AT&T became the sponsor the next year, and it's been known as that ever since. This is like if somebody today was going, the 1977 winner of the AT&T Pebble Beach Pro-Am was, when in 1977 it wasn't called the Pebble Beach Pro-Am, it was called the Bing Crosby Clam Bake, right? You see where I'm getting at? But for modern listeners, it would have no idea what the Bing Crosby Clam Bake is. They would have to refer to it under its modern name. I think that's why Ramses is there in Exodus 1. I do not think Ramses was alive in Exodus chapter 1. Okay? And but the name is there in Exodus 1, and so Hollywood took that and ran with it. And so every dramatization of this story that has ever been made that I have ever seen refers to that pharaoh as Ramses. Okay, I think that's where it comes from. Now, if you like, man, this has all been a bunch of names and dates, and you sound confused, and I'm confused, and yeah, okay. Why? Yes, sir.
Does the historical documentation by the Egyptian Historical Society, have they ever developed a calendar based on all these inscriptions on the walls of the pyramids and the walls of the temple? Have they ever developed a calendar that is different than what we're talking about?
Well, there are three different calendars, all made by both Egyptians and non-Egyptians. Again, that's the low, medium, and high revised calendars. But as to what all the sources are that went into that, again, I keep saying this. I'm not an Egyptologist. I'm doing my best here. So you guys, what I'm telling you is what I know. We try to go any further, and you're going to see there's nothing else there. Okay, so. I am being exposed here for what I don't know, and I freely admit that I do not know. But this is what I do know, okay? This is what this whole lesson is about. So if you don't get anything else but this, that's okay, because the rest of it doesn't really matter. I think there's some interesting stories in there, but the rest of it doesn't matter. And that's the last part of why is the Pharaoh not named in Exodus? And why, and I would even add to that, why is it not important that we know who the Pharaoh is? We sang just before this lesson song, Holy Ground. And, the time when God identified a place as being holy ground, I actually alluded to that this morning, was in Exodus chapter 3 in Moses before the burning bush. Right? And Moses, as we know, goes through a series of excuse after excuse after excuse. And I'm not saying that critically. I could only imagine the trepidation I would have of being asked to do what Moses was being asked to do. And one of his many questions was, who should I tell them has sent me? And I don't know if you remember this or not, but we did an entire class one night on the answer that God gave him. And so I'm not going to repeat that. But I do have two verses printed in the handout. Exodus 3, 14 and 15. This is God's answer to Moses. By the way, every time you see the name God in this text, that is the Hebrew Elohim. Okay? Anytime you see I am, it is the Hebrew Et-Yah. And when you see the Lord with O-R-D in small caps, it is the Hebrew Yahweh. Okay? And it's a very, very important answer. Because the name God, Elohim, is not a name. It's a title. Okay? It's a title. So you have the beginning, God, title, okay? Title, said to Moses, I am who I am. Et-yah. I am who I am. And he said, say this to the people of Israel. I am, Et-yah, has sent me to you. Now, Et-yah is not the name of God. Sometimes we talk about that God is, his name is I am. I am is what his name means. Okay? It's what his name means. And he comes down. It says, God also said to Moses, say to the people of Israel, and we lose this in all English translations because we do not put the name of God in our English translations. The next words say, the Lord. Tell them, the Lord. What does that actually say? Yahweh. It's not the same. It's not a synonym for God earlier. One's a title. One is a personal name. It's a personal name that literally means he is. You see how he is and I am fit together? It's just looking from opposite directions. Yahweh means he is. Ephiah means I am. So God says of himself, I am. Everyone else is to call him, he is. Brother, I got to get through this sermon, okay? If you would bear with me, please. He says, Yahweh, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. There's one God, and he's the same God, Yahweh. He is. That's who is sending you. That's who's sending you. There is such an emphasis here on God's name and what it means. I am. He is the singular, uncaused cause. If you go back and you believe that everyone has been created, ultimately you have to come to one who was not created, the I am. He emphasizes that's who you tell them to send. Now, below that, it says Pharaoh, this is in Exodus 5. Pharaoh said, and again, we lose this with our English translations. Who is Yahweh? Who's Yahweh? That's what he says. Who is Yahweh that I should obey his voice and let Israel go? I do not know Yahweh. Moreover, I will not let Israel go. This is not a story about Pharaoh. As Paul says in Romans 9, God used Pharaoh for his purpose. Pharaoh was one who was not going to follow God because he didn't know God. And so God used him to accomplish his purpose. But this is a story about the one, the only God. The ultimate uncaused cause. And so the reason why we don't know the name of Pharaoh is because this is a story about the name of God and what God did in rescuing his people, in overcoming a Pharaoh whose heart was hard, to rescue his people. Now, we talked about this, was that last week, about Purim? Yeah. You know, why was it important in Purim? Why is it important for Christians now thinking about what Purim represents, the salvation of Jews? Because without the people, the plan couldn't be executed. Same thing here. This was Yahweh, the one and only God, the ultimate uncaused cause, the I am. That he saved his people. Why? Because he had a plan to bring into the world the one Savior through his people. And this is a story about the salvation of his people. Yahweh is the name that is emphasized, not Pharaoh. And so again, all of my bumbling, trying to say, ultimately, make a random guess, and I have no idea who the Pharaoh was, it does not matter. It does not matter. Because what matters is we know the God who rescued them. We know the God who rescued them. This is a story about the deliverance that God gave, which was a shadow of the spiritual salvation that we now can have. Because why? Because God brought his plan to fruition through the people that he saved. He brought his son into the world, the Passover lamb, so that we can accept him as our Savior, to save us spiritually, not physically, spiritually. And that's what's left. That's why that's the only thing that matters with regard to names. The name of Pharaoh doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if it was Amenhotep or Ramses, or it does not matter. It doesn't matter. What matters is that we have a God who had a plan that he executed by having a people that he brought to fruition, that he brought to conclusion, so that we can have a Savior. That's all that matters. It doesn't matter whether we ever know who the Pharaoh is. It does not matter. And again, as I say every time, we have a choice to accept God's plan or not. And if you're here tonight and you never accepted God's plan, then we encourage you. There is no bigger decision, no more important decision. And we are never going to be ready, worthy of responding to his message. But God is ready to accept us where we are. Jeff, did a great job talking about the beginning of that journey this morning in his class. It is the beginning of a journey. It is the beginning of a journey. A journey walking with our Lord, with a new master, being surrounded by his grace. If you've never accepted him, we implore you to do that tonight. If there's anything else we can do for you, please come while we sing our invitation song.